cricket, lovely cricket. Cricket lick the ball before it reach the wicket.
Welcome along, it's Thursday the 21st of March. Cricket lick, spring is here. Reach the wicket. And the cricket season in England is a little over 2 weeks away. Incredible. Cricket. Excitement is building. Lots to pack in over the next hour as usual. Me and me girlfriend are dying. Later on I will have George DeBell from The Cricketer. He's been very vocal on Twitter since England lost their series to India, causing a lot of chat. I managed to get a hold of him. He'll be giving us the lowdown. And in yet another sad week for the world of cricket, Dick Davies from BBC Essex joins me to remember the great Robin Hobbs, who passed away at the weekend. It's really sad. Every week I seem to be reporting a cricket death. Robin Hobbs, last week was Duncan Fernley, before that Mike Proctor. Anyway, Dick is always very interesting and one of the great characters of Essex cricket, so we'll be talking to him. There'll be the usual roundup of news. There's lots going on as a few of the franchise tournaments come to a climax and get underway. There was 100 drafts last night, which threw up a few surprises. There's a few county comings and goings. And a bit of music thrown in as well. Don't go anywhere.
Got to lick the ball before it reach the wicket. The players in a full suit are white.
And you know the drill by now. This is 98 not out. And if you were wondering why it's called 98 on out, it's nothing to do with anyone's runs or anything like that. It's just because this is Phoenix FM, and Phoenix FM is 98 on the FM dial. You can also listen via the internet, phoenixfm.com, via Mixcloud, mixcloud.com, or as seems to be the most popular thing from people I talk to, shout at your smart speaker to play a Phoenix FM. And if you haven't got time for any of that, remember you can download the show and listen back whenever you want.
In a different style.
Just head to the Phoenix FM website, look for 98 out, and it will be there. And don't forget as well, there is the 98 out podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And the 98 out YouTube channel for a bit of video content. So let's get underway. It's cricket birthdays of the week. And as usual, a mixed bag of people celebrating this week. We'll start off with Roger Harper, 61 years old. Good friend of the show, Bumble, 77. Sean Udell, 55. Rangana Herath from Sri Lanka, 46. King of Spain, Ashley Giles, 51. Indian legend, Madan Lal, 73. Tamim Iqbal, 35. Patrick Foster, 37. West Indies legend, Alvin Kalicharan, hits 75. Closer to home, Matthew Maynard, 58. Grant Elliott from New Zealand, 45. Roston Chase, 32. Michael Atherton, 56. And a few listeners have got in touch. Kevin Thompson, 56 this week. Nigel Grindle, 53. Mark Harding, 62. Brian Edwards, 74. And Debbie Knight, 63. Happy birthday to everyone celebrating their birthdays this week. And as usual, if you want your name read out or someone you know, email radio@phoenixfm.com, title your mail 98 birthdays, and give me all the details, and I will add your person to the list.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
We'll have a bit of music to get going. This is Mark Butcher, a new one, As the Sun Hits the Sea.
I listen to multitudes as the sun hits the sea. Read the beats in my room. What is wrong with me? That wherever I end up, whatever the scene, there's always somewhere I should be. Harvest great beauty, consume sweet memory. Find reward in my duties. What's wrong with me? That wherever I end up, whatever the scene, there's always elsewhere I could be. Trauma, felt love's poetry. Place jewels upon you, nothing's wrong with me. But wherever I end up, whatever the scene, there's always somewhere I could be. They come in rolling tides, these thoughts are mine. Come paint a perfect picture by my side. Queenstown, Karachi, Trench Town to Sicily, Flamenca's mariachis. What the hell's wrong with me? That wherever I end up, whatever the scene, there's always elsewhere. Lord knows I care. Where I could be.
I know I'm biased, but he does sing a good song. That's Mark Butcher, As the Sun Hits the Sea. New music out soon.
98 FM. This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Last weekend, we received the sad news of the passing of Robin Hobbs, who's been a great figure to everyone that follows Essex cricket down the years. And I've got with me Dick Davis, who everyone that listens to BBC Essex and the fine commentary they do on the county cricket during the summer, you'll know Dick very well. Dick, welcome along. I'd like to just talk to you about the great man that was Robin Hobbs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't see much of him play, to be honest, because
you're far too young.
For a start, he was older than I am. Not a lot, I must admit, but he was. But also in those days, I was playing county cricket myself. So I mean, I've got to know him an awful lot better since he's retired and since he became almost a permanent fixture at the county ground at Chelmsford. And what a delight he was to know, really. I mean, I'm desperately sorry to hear of his death. I rather thought that he might not be well, because I don't think we saw much of him, if anything of him last season at the county ground. But he really was one of the most charming and amiable of men, a true gentleman. You can either say that as gentleman or gentleman, and the most modest and unassuming of men. And for professional sport, not just cricket, is all about blowing your own trumpet to a certain extent. You know, you've got to promote yourself. But he was so unassuming and self-effacing. It was really quite charming. And I'll miss him greatly around the county ground. And the county ground somehow, it just won't seem the same without him. And he was just modest in the extreme, and he even demonstrated this now, because before his death he made it clear that he didn't want any form of funeral whatever. No fuss, no big, you know, meetings and sharing of past memories. That's it, my lot's over. And I mean, that said, so much for him. I mean, he frequently used to come into the press box at the River End at Chelmsford, and he always sort of enlivened the place. He had that great talent of making everybody that he met feel really important. And you know, you could be having a bad day, or Essex could be having a bad day, or both, and Robin would come into the box, and it suddenly sort of brightened the day for everybody. And I'd usually say, "Robin, can I make you a cup of tea?" And he'd say, "Oh, thank you, dear boy, that's so kind of you." And he'd sit and have his cup of tea and natter, never about himself, but about Essex and how they were going on the day, or how he'd, or the season, or how he looked ahead to it. And then, but he didn't sort of overstay his welcome. I think that was probably in his mind, although I don't think he could have overstayed his welcome, because then he would sort of disappear. And rather than watch the match for a long time, as he was perfectly entitled to do from the committee box or the executive boxes or anything like that, you know, that sort of adulation, which undoubtedly would come his way, was not his style at all. And he'd just sit anywhere amongst the crowd. He was often to be found at what you might call the less glamorous end of the ground, the Hayes Close end. And, he was often to be found there just nattering to everybody and just talking to them generally. And he really was such good company, and we'll miss him desperately. And, of course, he played in the days when, which sadly has gone from professional cricket, professional football, professional rugby, probably almost any professional sport, the fun element of it has gone nowadays. You know, it can't be coincidence. I'm sure that that's because so much money has crept into it. But anybody who goes into sport professionally, almost uniquely, although I suppose show business is a bit the same, you don't go straight in as a professional cricketer or footballer or whatever you are. You know, you start doing it because you did it for fun as a boy or as a young teenager, and you thought, well, this is very good fun and I'm quite good at it. Sounds like a pretty good way of making a career, really. And he always had that element of fun about him. There are lots of people that, you know, have said words about him in praise. And I've got a quote from John Lever, who would have been his contemporary for most of the time, I suppose. And John said, or JK, as he's always been known, "I don't think you'll find anybody who says that it wasn't a pleasure to play with him or against him, because it certainly was." And Peter Parfitt said, "He was a bundle of fun all the time." And probably, maybe the greatest praise of all came from Doug Insull, who would have been his captain for much of the time. And Doug was a very good judge of people as well as of cricketers. And he said he was a great crowd pleaser, well-liked by friend and foe, as well-liked and friend and foe as any player in first-class cricket that I can ever remember. And you know, that is tremendous praise, I think. And the fact that, you know, you not only endear yourself to your teammates, your colleagues, the other 10 in the dressing room, but to the opposition as well. And of course, in those days, there was a great deal more of harmonising with the opposition. And you know, often they'd go out to socialise together in the evenings, and Robin would have always been at the centre of that. A great fella. And I think also, I've been doing a little bit of homework. I didn't know all these bits of information off the top of my head, but another indication as to how well he was liked are the sort of guest sides that he played for, other than Essex, not just Essex, England. And we're inclined to overlook 3 years at Glamorgan in the twilight of his career. But he played for the Cavaliers, the Taverners, the Duke of Norfolk's 11, D.H. Robin's 11, Tom Pierce's 11, Lavinia, Duchess of Norfolk's 11, the Duke of Beaufort's 11, Sir Paul Getty's 11. You don't sort of qualified to play for any of these other than by being pretty good at what you do. But, you know, you don't have to be a superstar, but most of all, what you might call a really good egg and fun to have in your side. And I think sort of that in itself, the list of all these other people that he played for, really sums the man up. And we're going to miss him greatly.
Yeah, he did turn out for, you talk about the travelling sides, but he turned out for the Wanderoos, where I have a tenuous link, and was great fun. And as you say, he's a reminder of a time when cricket and sport was a more gentler thing, more gentlemanly, and played in the right spirit. And you might have a glass or two after the game with the oppo to just discuss things. And I think Hobsey was a great example of how the game used to be played. I mean, I know times move on and things move on, but certainly I think when we sort of look at cricket through our rose-tinted glasses, that's the game that we want to, you know, think that it is. He was also involved with Hutton post the professional career, and could often be seen down at Hutton watching cricket. And there's even an award that was to this day is handed out at the annual presentations in Robin Hobbs's name for the Young Volunteer of the Year Award. And he was always quite popular on Twitter as well, writing in his trademark capital letters. Anyone that's ever received a correspondence from Robin would know that he loved caps lock in the manual form. But also, away from cricket, he was I think these days you call them a twitcher, don't you? An ornithologist. Yes. He had a great interest in birds, didn't he?
Yeah, I think twitter is the word, not twitcher.
Oh, was it Twitter? Ah, oh, okay.
I'm not sure. I'm not really up with such things. But yes, I mean, he probably wouldn't have fitted in the modern game. Well, for a start, purely, mainly as a leg spinner, although he was a very useful cricketer. He once got 100 against the Australians and a brilliant fielder. But, you know, he was a leg spinner. And when he packed up playing for England, it's quite significant that they went another 25 years, England did, before they had another leg spinner in the side. Now, of course, that's changed quite a lot, for which God rest his soul, Shane Warne must be, you know, largely responsible. It suddenly became quite glamorous and almost sexy to be a leg spinner. But, you know, there was an enormous interval between Robin Hobbs and the rest that followed. And so he was not the last, but, you know, certainly the last before a long, long interval. And I'm glad to see that the leg spinners are returning into the game, because cricket at every level, to my mind, test match level, county level, club level, it's always a bit, that's why he became a leg spinner, except it maybe he didn't have the build to be a seam bowler. But it's always fun when there's a spinner on, because either they're taking wickets or the ball's being dispatched to the boundary. It's seldom dull, and I think that applies especially to a leg break bowler, because of all the manners of spinning the ball. Leg breaks are notoriously difficult to control. I speak as one who several decades ago tried it myself and failed miserably. So, he was a man for his time. And it's a good job he was, because, another 20 years afterwards, and he probably wouldn't have. Yeah, he might have struggled to get a county cap, let alone an England cap.
Yeah, I just found. I mean, he was quite active on Twitter, and I found a lovely tweet of his, which I think would be a lovely epitaph for him. It says, in his own words, "My son always seems to remember me being hit for big sixes, but cannot recall me getting G. Pollock, G. Sobers and C. Lloyd all out in one over."
No, that's quite an achievement.
That's right.
And I mentioned in passing, it just dawned on me that I mentioned in passing, almost offhand, he happened to get 100 against the Australians, against the Australian touring side. That was when, in the days when the touring side...
That was in 44 balls, wasn't it?
Sorry?
That was in 44 balls.
Yes, it was. Yes, of course, that was a big omission of mine. Yes, that was the whole point of it. It was in 44 deliveries. And, the Australians in those days, the tourists entered into the spirit of things as well. And it was a game which the Australians were bound to win. And Essex were batting in the fourth innings, and they needed some monstrous total to win, which they were never going to get. And Robin Hobbs came in, and yeah, the Aussies took to him as well. He always described it afterwards as he said, I know that the records show I got 100 in 44 minutes, he said, but it's only because they put the pie chuckers on. And apparently, after a while, once he got his 100, the Australian captain at the time, who I must admit I can't remember who it was, said to him, right, okay, Hobbsley, you enjoyed yourself. We've enjoyed watching you. I'm going to bring Jeff Thompson on again at the next over, because he didn't have to face the great and much feared Jeff Thompson, who was probably one of the fastest bowlers ever to have let go of a cricket ball. He said, OK, I'm going to bring on Tomo at the far end after the end of this over. And Robin thought about this, and the next delivery, he deliberately holed out to long arm. He did not want to face Jeff Thompson, and I don't blame him either.
Absolutely brilliant. Fond memories, and a great man who will be sadly missed, I think, not only around the confines of Essex and Hutton, but across the greater game. It will be it's a sad loss, and we pay tribute to the life and times of Robin Hobbs.
Yes, most certainly. I'll endorse that.
Lovely words from BBC Essex's Dick Davis. Make sure you catch him over the summer. He'll be commentating, as usual, on the Essex County Cricket Club matches, and spoke very, very beautifully there about the late Robin Hobbs, who passed away at the weekend, aged 81.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
The March edition of County Cricket Matters is now out. It has an interview with James Woo of Somerset. It also has articles by a wonderful writer, David Woodhouse, and articles by Alan Wilkins. Lots more. And of course, there's a crossword. Do subscribe. It's a fantastic bargain at £3.
With the English season rapidly approaching, it must mean one thing: the arrival of the April edition of the Cricketer magazine, a bumper 116-page special with two pages on each of the 18 first-class counties and our hugely popular fixtures wall chart. We also have Vic Marks, George DeBell, David Gower, Liam Plunkett, Nick Friend, Mike Selby and Tanya Aldred. That's all in the April edition of the Cricketer magazine, out now.
Right, let's have a bit of music. Here come the B-52s, and after that, I'll be back with George DeBell.
If you see a faded sign at the side of the road that says 15 miles to the
Love Shack! Love Shack, yeah. I'm heading down the Atlanta Highway, looking for the love getaway. Headed
the B-52s and a Love Shack. Now that always reminds me of when I played for Shenfield back in the early 90s. That was the victory song after a winning performance down at Holland's Wine Bar with Skin Daddy on the decks. That one was always played at loud volume. I'm joined now by George DeBell, old friend of the show and a great supporter of us. 2 years ago, England were in one of their regular doldrums after losing the Ashes in Australia and getting a reality check in the West Indies. And it was the end of Silverwood and Root. And then in came Stokes and McCullum, and it was Bazball, and everything was fine for a while. But over the last 12 months or so, the wheels have come off.
Well, I don't know that the wheels have come off. They've played tougher opposition and they were a wee bit complacent at times. You know, if their lives had depended on it, would they have won in Wellington? They might have done. I don't know. But, you know, they've certainly played tougher opposition. Look, the premise of what I'm saying goes back to the idea that everything improved very radically when these guys were appointed. And it is quite true that England had won 1 in 17, famously, before Stokes and McCullum came together. I'm saying that that gave them an opportunity, really, to say almost whatever they did was a step forward. And I definitely think that they did, have done and continue to do some admirable things. But we aren't comparing like for like, I think. For one thing, England played a lot of tests in COVID lockdown conditions. And accumulatively, they began to hurt. They played away series in, well, certainly Australia and India, which are the toughest series anyway. And I wasn't sure that we were comparing apples and pears. It wasn't even apples and o-pears when we're talking about playing, you know, England playing at home. And there was a release, I think, when these guys took over. Not just in approach, which isn't miles away from the Trevor Bayliss years, but also a release from the conditions that they were under in COVID. And the combination of those things, plus very good flat wickets, gave them a freedom. And it was a joy. It has been a joy. There's lots of good things about it. But I do think it is worth looking at the record before COVID as well. And the record of the current team now and the team going into COVID is almost identical. And just to go into some detail with that, if this England side win the first test of the series against West Indies at Lord's, they will have won, I think, 14 out of 25. Well, going into COVID, England had won 14 out of 25. So I think that's a fair point to make. It's not to say that you can completely discount the COVID tests. Of course you can't. But there's a context there. There is an asterisk in my head against those results. And while Australia, for example, didn't play a single test away in COVID, England played all the bloody time. And it wore them down. And I was in Australia on that Ashes tour, and it was grim for them. You know, they didn't do any proper training going into the series, no warm-up games and stuff. Clearly, it's always an uphill struggle to win in Australia. But on that time, it didn't really even feel competitive. It was just being played to get the broadcast deals honoured so that the money could keep coming in. And that's fine. We get that. But I think the fact that England then had through that grim run of form with 1 win in 17 and stuff sort of gave this regime a get out of jail free card. And I just think we should look at a little bit more at how they're doing. And my big issue, I suppose, is not so much a criticism of this regime, because, you know, I wasn't one of the ones saying sack Silverwood and Giles or actually Peter Moores going way back or, you know. But I do think what the ECB have done is a distraction. What are the big problems in English cricket? Well, let's go professional cricket. The county structure is a nonsense. You know it, I know it, pretty much everybody knows it. It is not a high-performance environment. Anyway, the schedule is all over the place, and I think everyone agrees that it could be improved. But there's so many competing priorities and financial demands that it's very difficult to do that. We all appreciate that. But actually, that's one way that you could really genuinely improve the England side. But it's thorny and difficult. Equally, we know the pathway isn't really very good. We know that it is predominantly reliant on private schools. There's a stat bubbling around about, you know, roughly 25-26% of England qualified county cricketers went to 19 private schools. Come on now. So my point is, what would happen if we had 2,000 schools producing that level of talent? And okay, that's not realistic overnight. We know that these problems, again, are thorny and expensive and tricky. But let's grapple with those eventually. Let's think about those rather than just saying we're going to appoint a charismatic leader and we're going to fool you into thinking everything's going to be all right. Because actually, results now have reverted to the norm. And they will. We're asking for miracles for England to win in Australia or India. It's two wins in the last 29 tests England have had in those countries. Two out of 29. Now, people will say, rightly, it's very hard to win there. And it is. It's meant to be. When did people in England accept that it's almost impossible to win in India or Australia? When did one of the superpowers of world cricket accept that they were going to get thrashed abroad? I don't think that's good enough, no. I think we should. I actually think it's a very optimistic approach, by the way. I believe it could be better. I don't say it's easy, but I think the whole McCullum thing is a distraction. Nothing against him. He's an inspirational figure. He is. He's done amazing things in cricket. He's not a cricket coach, though. He wouldn't even pretend to be. You could call him a mentor, but he's not really a coach. And the idea that they don't need coaching at the top level doesn't look like it, does it?
You think there's Steve Harmison lit a bonfire under this just before England started this tour about the approach and the attitude that for whatever reason, good or bad, it's more laid back, it's not as competitive. And there seemed to me, just personally, that in this series, when a game looked lost, England almost gave up and thought, well, we'll have a day off, we'll go and play golf, we'll lie on the beach or go back to the hotel. Going down without even trying. Is that symptomatic?
I don't agree with that. I don't think they would know how not to try, but I think that they are big on pressure off. And if you're over tense, it doesn't bring the best out of you. So I think there's some merit in that approach. But as ever, there's a balance. And I think the messaging from McCullum isn't terribly helpful at times. You know, the whole thing. Well, I'll give you an example, actually, but one of the first times it struck me, and he was proved right. We were in Hamilton, New Zealand, and there was a warm-up game under lights. I think it was meant to be a four-day game, and then it became a two-day game, I think. And England either declared, they didn't bat under lights in the warm-up game by choice. They took the day off and went for dinner and, you know, all the normal things. So they had an early finish. And I said to him, why not take the opportunity to bat under lights? And he said, well, we could have done that. That's, you know, one way of doing it. But I think the negativity, the doubt that would have been created by doing that would have been unhelpful. Interesting, yeah? So then they go and play the first test in Mount Maunganui under lights. And they declared, didn't they, just before the lights came on or just as the lights were coming on. So Stuart Broad gets into bowl. And I'm getting my days mixed up, but you get the picture of what I'm saying is they kind of avoided batting under lights as much as possible and bowled under lights as much as possible. And I think they declared on the first day there as well. And it worked. You know, they won and won handsomely. So these things aren't black and white. It's not as if he's not an unintelligent man, Brendan McCullum. But I think the messaging has become simplistic I think there needs to be a bit more nuance about it. And I don't see attributes as a coach. He's a mentor, fine. But I think sometimes with this particular England team, the selections they've made, you know, bear in mind it's only a few weeks since Ben Stokes said he didn't think he'd be picking Alistair Cook you know, even if Alistair Cook was at the sort of peak of his career, putting the words in his mouth a bit, but you remember the expression. Because that's not the way this team want to play. Well, to me, that's hubristic nonsense. You do still need to score some runs, and you know, 5 days is quite a long time. There's still, I think, the need to build a game upwards from a defensive technique. And I think we've just seen that. I think we've seen proof of that. So, you know, I don't mean to be completely... I certainly don't mean to be rubbishing lots of the good things they've done, and there's certainly a lot of fun to watch. But it does feel a bit simplistic. And I was worried after, I can't remember which test it was, Rajkot, I think, when McCullum was saying, no, we're not going to review things. We're not going to talk about what we did wrong. It puts negativity into the mind. And for me, that is, again, simplistic. And I don't agree that we can't reflect and criticize ourselves and take criticism from mentors or coaches and improve. I mean, I think that's just part of the learning process. So I'd be a bit worried about them. I feel that there's an awful lot of support for the regime generally, and that is good. And it does feel that they have won over people who maybe had become a little bit disillusioned. But the idea that England didn't used to play attractive cricket is not true. They just went through a period under COVID where they lost their way and were miserable and overworked. And I think it was unfair what they were asked to do, actually. And because they didn't complain about it, bless them, I'm not sure people realised how rubbish it was. Anyway, we're not comparing like for like when we compare the regimes, is my point. And actually, the results are exactly the same, but this one had a bit more sparkle. And so they're getting away with it.
Is there a difference between what the public see and what goes on behind closed doors with this team? You know, there's the projection to the media and the viewing public of, you know, it's all quite laid back, but really, you know, there's a lot of introspection going on, a lot of analysing of what they've done or what could be done better.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's a lot of analysing. No, I think they're generally about pressure off, and that's not completely wrong, but there has to be a balance. You know, you don't want to go, obviously, well, not obviously, but I knew Jonathan Jordan, know Jonathan Trott quite well, and obviously watched his unravelling with concern, and he would have been someone who could have done with a bit of this approach. Quite a lot of that team would have been. And I think if you know, you see how Andy Flower coaches now, he has mellowed and become wiser and softer, probably. Alex Stewart too, probably. I think there's that's a good thing that needed to happen. But, you know, any extreme becomes a little bit of a worry. I'll just make this point, I suppose. This is my concern. Are England on course to win the Ashes in Australia? Well, I don't think they are. Now, you might think, and people obviously are saying this to me on Twitter, well, England hardly ever win the Ashes. What should change now? Well, shouldn't that be the aim? I mean, why are we sitting around thinking, you know, can't win the Ashes, it's impossible. What's the point of that? So I think we should aspire to more, aspire to better. And you know, I hope I'm not being binary in my assessments. I'm really not meaning to be. I just think that I wasn't feeling that what I was seeing was being said, if I'm honest. Anyway, that's sort of my role. I thought I should say it as I see it and tell the truth. And it's been a bit more controversial than I thought, I suppose. But, that happens.
Yeah. It's funny. I was in sort of reading and looking at all these reports the last few days. Like, my mind gets cast back 10 years or so to that England team that did win in Australia. And you know, sort of from 2010 to 2013, 14 seemed to be all conquering. And it's made me think about why was that team so good and what were they doing that was so right to get those
results? I think I can tell you.
Go on.
Well, they weren't all conquering. But for one thing, they lost 3-0 in Pakistan within the UAE, which is a really interesting series in quite a lot of ways. But, you know, the general point you make is right. I mean, obviously, they won in Australia. They won in India. And they also won the T20 World Cup, which was the first global tournament ever won by the England men's side. So they did some really, really terrific things. They weren't a dour side. I mean, for goodness sake, they had KP in it. but they were a very good side. I would argue that they were developed to a large extent in the years when county championship cricket was really tough and really strong. So we had just brought in two divisions, promotion and relegation, four-day cricket. I think that was the turn of the century, wasn't it? So you'd had a few years of that. You had good overseas players, you had good Colpack players, for good and bad. And you had a championship system that was everyone played everyone home and away. So it had some integrity. It had some status. It mattered. And to some extent, the world's changed, and that's no one's fault. And to some extent, we've taken our eye off the ball, because I'm always going to think, if you get the county game right, if you get the domestic game right, the England teams are largely going to look after themselves. Not completely. But, you know, you've got to get the bottom of the pyramid right. And actually, the county game clearly isn't the bottom of the pyramid. But I think you take the point I'm saying. So I think that's why there are a lot of things came together. Maybe a freakish group of players up to a point. But I don't think you could believe in the cyclical nature of these things completely. It's too laissez-faire. You know, if you're in charge of English cricket, you can't just say, yeah, that was a good phase, this is a bad phase. That's not good enough. You know, it is a multi-million pound business. You have to be able to direct the course of events, not just sit back and say, yeah, shucks, this happens. And sort of proving the point that 9-13 side did really good things. Four of the top seven scored centuries on test debut, which I think shows that the county game was preparing them. And just to prove that point, it was Strauss, Cook, Trott and Pryor. Two more scored half centuries, Bell and KP. One of them got a fifer, Jimmy Anderson, and another one, Graham Swan, took two wickets in his first over. I think all that suggests that the county game was preparing better. And I think we should look at why that was. Actually, I think, to be honest, we all know why that was. The reasons I just said. So then we have to be strong enough to make the difficult decisions. And it's very difficult. You see, people just think I'm anti the 100, and it's not as simple as that. I enjoy watching the 100. Enjoy all the formats. I don't even have a favourite. But the problem, whenever you have a window in the middle of the season where you're playing basically one format and it's clearly compromising the others, is that there'll be knock-on effects. And the collateral damage of doing this, whether it's the 100 or even if it being the blast, is that you are compromising the effectiveness of your test side and actually your ODI side as well. So there's a lot of feel-good in English men's cricket at the moment. And I think it needs a reality check, because otherwise we'll keep going the same way. You know, England were humbled in the ODI Men's World Cup, yeah? No way around it. They haven't actually won a men's T20 international series since 2022, when, to be fair, they won the World Championship. You know, so you know, it's not rubbish, is it? But you know, and they haven't won a multi-match test series since 2022. Well, that seems to me to be quite sobering. And sobering isn't necessarily bad. Sobering maybe means that you look at what the issues are, you reflect on them and you change them. I don't see realism as a bad thing. I think this is an optimistic stance.
So West Indies are going to be here at Lord's in July. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, or does that depend on which West Indies team turns up to test England?
Look, you would think at this stage, with England's home record and West Indies record in England in recent times, that England go into that as favourites. It's neither a good or a bad thing. I'm, you know, always nice to see West Indies. Glad that England are hosting West Indies. If you mean, is it an opportunity for England to win and say, see, told you everything's all right? Maybe. I don't know how long I've been doing this. It's a long time since I've seen England win in West Indies. Was it 2009 or something? Is it even before that? So it's a long time, yeah? And we all saw West Indies win in Australia. So I don't know which West Indies is going to turn up. And I definitely wouldn't want to dismiss their chances. I mean, as I say, England start as favourites. But the other thing is England might want to look ahead. I would look at a team, start to look at players with a view to the Ashes as well. So, you know, it doesn't mean don't pick Jimmy Anderson, but I would ask the question what you're going to learn by picking Jimmy Anderson. And you know, maybe look after Mark Wood. Some of these guys will have just come back from the T20 World Cup. Mark Wood's quickest bowler England have ever had, potentially. And I don't know whether you need to play him in all the tests as well. He's a special player. And so I don't know. I would like them to look ahead and plan. But all these things will be seen as negative thoughts. You know, this is the sort of stuff that Silverwood said, and people said he was overly complex. But I thought I saw quite a lot of merit in what Silverwood and Giles were doing, to be honest. I just thought they were dealt a terrible, terrible hand by COVID and the fact that the ECB wanted them to fulfil the fixture list, whatever the results. And I just, not saying you discount it, I'm just saying bear it in mind. Just keep that context, have a little asterisk next to those results in your mind. Because 1 in 17 compared to what's happening now, I think that distorts the truth a bit.
Well, we don't have too long to wait until the English season starts and we can get a grip on what's going on both at county level and national level. George, I know you're busy and you're a bit pressed for time, so we'll wrap it up there.
Nice to
brilliant as always to talk.
Sorry if I've ranted at you. Anytime.
People tune in to listen to the guests, not me, I'll tell you. Great to talk, and go well, and we'll catch up soon.
Cheers, mate.
The always excellent George DeBell. Do you agree, disagree? Join the conversation on X or Twitter, whatever you call it, and also on Facebook. Okay, let's whistle through some of the news that's going on. We'll start with women's cricket. Royal Challengers Bangalore claimed their first Women's Premier League title with an 8-wicket victory over Delhi Capitals in the final in Delhi. Delhi crumbled from 64 without loss to 87 for 7 and were bowled out for 113 in the 19th over, with Shreyanka Patil taking 4 for 12. RCB laboured slightly in their chase of 114, but Australian all-rounder Elise Perry's unbeaten 35 helped them to reach their target with 3 balls to spare. Delhi have now lost both finals of the first 2 Women's Premier League tournaments. In Pakistan, in the PSL, which is also completed this week, Islamabad United beat Multan Sultans in a final ball thriller to win the PSL and become the first team to claim 3 PSL titles. Islamabad's title, third title, puts them one ahead of Lahore Qalandars, while Multan have now lost 3 successive finals since their only triumph back in 2021. Islamabad bowler, very own Tamal Mills, said, "Most games have gone down to the wire. It is great to win a brilliant game in front of a packed crowd and to cap off an excellent tournament." Worth noting as well that former England World Cup winning spinner Alex Hartley was part of Multan's coaching team, alongside ex-Ireland international Kath Dalton, of these parts, well-known to everyone at Hutton, who is the first woman to be a fast bowling coach in a professional team. The IPL is about to get underway tomorrow, with its 17th edition, with defending champions Chennai Super Kings hosting RCB. That starts at 2:30 our time, and we could see MS Dhoni against Virat Kohli in the opening game. Talk about box office. The date for the final is unknown, but the last weekend in May is likely. As usual, there are a host of stars involved, but there are some big-name English absentees. Harry Brooke has pulled out following the death of his grandmother, while bowlers Mark Wood and Gus Atkinson and batter Jason Roy have opted out to manage their workload. Test captain Ben Stokes and Joe Root opted not to enter the auction for the same reasons. But English players are there. Moeen Ali is at Chennai Super Kings. Phil Salt is at KKR. David Willey's at Lucknow Super Giants. Johnny Bairstow, Liam Livingstone, Sam Curran and Chris Wokes are at Punjab Kings. Joss Butler and Tom Kolar-Cadmore at Rajasthan Royals. And Will Jacks, Rhys Topley and Tom Curran are at RCB. Coming closer to home now in the counties. Australian all-rounder Will Sutherland will not join Somerset this season due to an unspecified injury. He was due to play at the start of the season and in the T20 Blast for the reigning champions, but the club has said that he will now undergo rehabilitation in Australia. Essex fans will say that the same thing happened with Sutherland last year. Another Australian, Aaron Hardy, has pulled out of a spell with county champion Surrey from May to July. He was due to be available for the first 3 games, but in a club statement, he's been withdrawn by Cricket Australia in order to manage his workload.
Indian left-arm pace bowler Jadhav Unadkat has signed to play for Sussex in the final five games of this year's Summer County Championship season. He will return to Hove, having played in three of their final four Red Ball games in 2023. He took 11 wickets, an average of 24.18. And finally, in the 100, yes, I've left the best till last. Snigger. David Warner has been snubbed by all eight franchises in last night's draft, as was Babar Azam. And in other surprises, in the women's draft, Harmanpreet Kaur and Jemima Rodriguez were also surprise names that failed to attract interest. That's it. That's me done for another week. Hope you enjoyed the show. Listen back on Catch Up. Head to phoenixfm.com. The wonderful John Chubb is sat poised like a panther, ready to spring and launch the non-league hour at 7 o'clock. My thanks to my guests tonight, George LaBelle and Dick Davis. That man Butcher's back here to play us out. This is Cold Eyes, Cold Heart.
Across Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.